Hi, this is Rick, and welcome to A Fair Recovery Radio tonight. And with me, I have the dynamic duo, the couple with no limits, John and Leslie.
Hey there.
the happiest married couples next to me and Stephanie probably in the nation.
At least on air right now.
I'm just sucking up to him right now. And last week we began dealing with the 20 most common mistakes the unfaithful spouse makes. So were you going to say something, Leslie?
Oh, I was going to say last week we talked about four of them, and John's just going to give us a recap.
Yeah, this is what we talked about last week. And the number one most common mistake the unfaithful spouse makes is believing that once you and your affair partner have decided to do the right thing and return to your marriages, that the affair is indeed over. Second was leaking out information over time. Third was being defensive. Fourth was believing everything your mate says. And that brings us to tonight, where we begin with number five, living life as normal.
Well, we have a term at the Fair Recovery Center we call living life as normal, pretend normal. And for the hurting spouse, if the unfaithful spouse acts like everything is normal, the betrayed spouse begins to lose a lot of hope because they think this person has no idea what they've done. They don't care. It doesn't matter. And they're just trying to smooth it over like nothing happened.
Right. I think that we have a term we use all the time called pretend normal. And that drives people crazy. And one of the things that we've begun doing that I think is very useful, just so that we don't live life as normal for couples in recovery, and I highly recommend this, is each day talk to your mate and just sit there and say, today it's my heart's desire, it's my heart's intent to walk in sobriety. Today it's my heart's intent to walk in fidelity towards you, or today it's my intent to walk with God. Because just making that statement to your mate actually lets them know that you're not going around as if nothing has happened. And to not acknowledge to your mate on a daily basis that you know this is an issue, even if you're just saying my intent today is to walk in sobriety, it leaves them wondering, and it creates a great deal of fear for them. And it may seem funny, it may seem counterintuitive to think that bringing that up and saying, hey, it's my intent to walk in sobriety today, you would think that that may be upsetting, but I think that for the hurt spouse, that's something that is really meaningful. Have you seen that with any of your clients?
Oh, I think it's been extremely helpful. And I guess a couple of other things that I would add that are really helpful to say every day in some way. One of them is to say, thank you so much that you're still here. The fact that you haven't left means so much to me. And the other thing is to be able to say, I'm really grieved over the pain that I've caused you. Because I think if you can also say those two things every day in some way, that the spouse is really, really relieved. A lot of times the unfaithful spouse thinks, gosh, if I bring it up, I'm going to remind them and they're going to start thinking about it. Actually, they're thinking about it all the time. And when you mention it, it's a relief to them that you're thinking about it too and you care enough to bring it up.
Right. John, do you want to add anything and all that? So I'll put you
no,
on the
you
spot.
No, you guys are rocking and rolling, so I'm just going to sit over here and be Ed McMahon to your Johnny Carson.
Let me say, I just thought of one more thing I want to get in on this one, living life is normal. A lot of times I think it's the tendency of the hurt spouse to ignore their mate. When they see their mate's really upset, they want to pretend that, again, nothing's wrong.
You mean the hurt spouse or the unfaithful?
No, when the unfaithful spouse sees the hurt spouse.
Right.
Yes, thank you. They will kind of act as if nothing's wrong. And I'll tell you, we call it, our term is be a tornado chaser. Rather than running to the storm shelter and kind of trying to get away from the other person, if you will go straight at them and say, looks like you're having problems, and acknowledge it, you're way ahead of the game, because at least they know you're concerned and that you care.
Well, because the other thing is that sometimes there's a gender difference between men and women. Most men, if they're upset with their spouse, want to be left alone. Most women, if they're hurt by their mate, they want their mate to be the one that comforts them. So even when your spouse may look like a cactus, it's important to remember that they have a soft and tender heart that's in a lot of pain.
Okay, John.
Which leads us to number six, and I don't particularly recommend this one. trying to defend your affair partner.
Well, and sometimes this actually happens very naturally, because the hurt spouse will say something like, I don't understand how your affair partner went after you, or they seduced you. And the person who's been unfaithful sometimes is trying to take responsibility for their own actions and unintentionally sounds like they're defending the affair partner when they're actually trying to take their responsibility for their actions.
Actually, I can plead guilty to this one. And so I certainly can be the one who can say, this is not a good idea. I think in reality, I really did want to take 100% responsibility for what had happened in our relationship and the failure that it was not my affair partner's problem. At the same time, guys, my wife needed to be able to be upset with my affair partner. And while it was nice that I wanted to take 100% responsibility from her perspective, and this is very true, my affair partner also had some responsibility in this thing. She did not have to say yes. And so in that sense, if they sense that you're defending the affair partner, then at one level they're going to feel like you're still in a covert alliance with your affair partner. And at that point, one of Stephanie's great sayings to me is like, exactly how loud am I going to have to get before you hear me? And that would usually cause one of those nice little escalations of getting loud. So I certainly recommend don't defend the affair partner. Sit there and take responsibility and say, you know what? I can't say on their part. I can say that, you know, I've got to take responsibility for what I did. I know that they did some things. You know, maybe you need to talk to them, whatever. So anything else you would add to that? Because that's a scary one. I remember that. Those were some bad days.
Well, it is scary, but I do want to emphasize it happens quite naturally over and over and over in discussions.
Right.
And particularly for you guys out there, you want to really avoid number 7 as well, trying to avoid talking with your spouse about their feelings.
Which may be a challenge anyway for most guys. But as we mentioned before, even if your spouse is expressing her hurt and fear through anger, most women really want to be heard by their spouse and comforted by their spouse.
Yeah, when you first read that, I thought you were saying try to avoid talking about your feelings. The opposite, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, try to avoid. You know, I think that to expect them to be rational at this point, at the point of a lot of pain, and to want to avoid dealing with that is going to be somewhat in the realm of unproductive and somewhat insane even. And I just let them have their feelings. One of the things that our mates need to be able to heal once we've hurt them is we have to be able to be a safe vessel of anger for them, a place where they can have feelings and we allow them to have feelings and that they'll be okay. Can I tell a story?
Go ahead.
Okay,
I'll
tell a story. Once upon a time, when I was working actually, back at Minrith Meyer, I walked out of my door one day and there was a black trash bag with a dead flower arrangement, something I'd never seen before. It had a black vase, black roses, black daisies, and just dead flowers. And so there was a little note attached to it, and when I opened it up, it was from a woman, and the note read as follows. I'm angry at my father for all of the sexual abuse that he perpetrated against me. And I'm really angry at my husband because he doesn't know what to do with me. And I'm angry at all the boys in high school who took advantage of me. And I'm especially angry at all the good boys in high school who had nothing to do with me. And I'm angry at Dr. Hayden because he doesn't know that he needs to see me. And finally, I'm angry at you because you were too slow in calling me back. And she said, is that okay? Because it seems like you're the only one it's really safe to be angry at. And that was probably one of the greatest compliments that one of my clients ever paid me, that I was the one place that she could really be angry and feel safe. And if we can do that for our mate, be a safe place for them to be angry, it really does help facilitate their healing. I'm not talking about be a safe place for someone to abuse you. That's not my point. But for someone to be able to be angry and for you to be able to stay present with them and still love them and still be compassionate toward them and let them talk about their pain, that is amazing in terms of being able to, for them to feel heard, because that really facilitates healing.
Right. And your spouse is going to be an emotional roller coaster for a very long time. You may have some peaceful moments and you think, oh, they've gotten past it. But they're going to probably have another reminder, be very hurt, be very upset again. And so if you can ride out the roller coaster and not hurry them along, it will actually benefit both of you all.
And I guess we're coming up against a break here, but when we get back, we will continue with our 20 most common mistakes that the unfaithful spouse makes.
Welcome back to Affair Recovery Radio, Radio to the Power of God. And I'm sitting here again with my co-hosts, John and Leslie, tonight. And this is I Am Rick. And we tonight are talking about the 20 most common mistakes that the unfaithful spouse makes. And as Leslie was pointing out in our break here, I need to pay closer attention, so I just repeated her. But that's the first time I have ever done that.
I really don't think so, but that's okay.
Well, it's good to have dementia. At least I don't remember the last time I did it. So my dad always says there's a difference between Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's. The Alzheimer's is the Alzheimer's degrees. You forget something and you don't know you forgot it. Alzheimer's, you forget something and you know you forgot it. You just don't know what it is.
So you have Alzheimer's.
Yeah, something like that. I had no idea. So as we go along here, please give us a call at 365-9930. That's area code 512-365-9930. And especially if you've got a comment about a mistake that you may have made as an unfaithful spouse.
Yeah, don't be shy on that. We've all made them.
Exactly. And because I think it's going to be good for us to be able to listen. You know, what are the things we need to avoid as we go through this process?
But also, just to add on to that, if you have made these mistakes, we're not trying to throw blame at you. We're just trying to say these are things that a lot of people do. That's what makes them so common. But have some grace with yourself and maybe just learn from it.
So, John, what's our next one?
Rolling right along. Number 8, pointing out your spouse's faults and failures.
Yikes. Yeah. Okay, number... Yeah.
Well, you know, when we talk to clients, one of the things that we try to point out as they're talking about what led up to the affair is that it's really important to be able to separate the marriage from the affair or the train wreck, as we sometimes refer to it. If you guys are going to be able to have restoration and reconciliation, there's going to be a day then you're going to need to talk about the marriage, but you really have to get through the train wreck first. Because if you bring up the marriage in the midst of the pain, your spouse, your hurting spouse, is only going to hear blame. And they're going to hear them telling... Well, they're going to hear their spouse telling them that it's their fault that they had the affair.
Right. I think that we talk about the process, the three-step process that you've got to go through to recover from some form of infidelity. And if you jump that process and start with trying to heal what the deficits were in that marital relationship in the beginning, you will get nowhere. That will only come across, as Leslie says, as defensiveness. In reality, you first have to deal with the hurt that's created by the infidelity, and then in short order, we try to move on to deal with what are the other problems in the marriage. Because obviously, marriages had affairs, had problems before the infidelity, but at the same time, the infidelity was not created by those deficits. They may have been contributing factors, but they certainly are not what caused it. And you first have to deal with beginning to create a sense of safety and fidelity before we begin to jump on to what were the other deficits in that marriage and the problems with your mate.
We've had a lot of couples that were down the road a bit from discovery of the infidelity, and they had actually been to other counselors, and when they went to see the other counselors, the counselors helped them try to fix the marriage, and then about a year or two later, the person who had been hurt was really upset because they felt like, well, yeah, we have a great marriage, but my spouse still doesn't understand the pain that they caused, and they get stuck there.
Mm-hmm. And for you betrayers out there, you know, that's not to say that you're always going to be the scapegoat for everything that's going wrong in the relationship, but you've got to deal with the infidelity first. You just can't can't try to throw that all in the same cauldron.
Absolutely.
All right. Number 9, taking your spouse to the same places you frequented with your affair partner. Heard lots of stories on this one.
Bad idea. A lot of times, the person, and maybe it's just a lack of creativity on our part as human beings, but we'll take our affair partner to the places that we really enjoyed the most, that have been very meaningful, or maybe we'll find a really cool place during an affair, and then we think it'll be really great to share that with our mate after the affair is over, or, well, it doesn't work. Because ultimately what's happening is all of these places end up being very, very painful reminders of the affair for your mate. And don't think that they're not going to find out someday. Most likely they will find out that y'all had been there. So I recommend leaving those places alone.
Well, and I would even add that sometimes the hurt spouse remembers the places more carefully than the person who's been unfaithful. So they may remember where the affair partner and their spouse has been, even though their spouse has already forgotten.
Yeah, I've had a couple cases with some of my clients where they actually ran into the affair partner at the old place where they used to go.
And so, yeah, that actually happened to one of my people last week that's out of state. And actually, it was her opinion the affair partner actually showed up there on purpose. Just because she's angry about what happened, and so she is now frequenting all of the places where they hang out.
Yeah, so it's a good opportunity to explore some of the new and creative dining and entertainment options in your city's area and not go back to those old tried and true and dangerous places.
Now, whatever you do, never take your affair partner to Starbucks. Just a word.
Right. Okay, Rick, I think you have to explain that. I don't think you can just leave that there.
Well, I was just saying, if you go to a chain, then every time your affair partner, I mean, not your affair partner, but your mate sees a Starbucks, it's going to be a trigger, and they're not going to like Starbucks anymore.
Right. Yeah, that includes Burger King, McDonald's, things like that, too, because
that's
really...
That's true.
I mean, I know nobody – if anybody had the type of forethought to avoid those types of things, they would certainly avoid having the affairs in the first place, because that is just – it is such a painful thing for your mate, guys. And we're kind of laughing over here, and I'm not trying to make fun of that.
Yeah, we don't mean to be insensitive to those of you who are hurting.
No, but literally you're talking about, you know, creating a reminder on every corner.
Right. Every time they drive past it, they're going to remember your affair.
Which is why we feel like, you know, that you've got to avoid these sorts of things.
So, rolling right along. Number 10, telling a lie of any sort.
Any sort. If your spouse asks you what you had for breakfast and you say eggs, it really needs to be eggs. Because when it's all said and done, the hurting spouse, for them to be able to recover from the infidelity, they need to think that the unfaithful spouse is being 100% honest. And that means not lying about anything, not white lies, not lies of omission, that a lie, anything that looks like a lie, is going to be a huge reminder and set everybody back to square one.
Right. I don't know what else I would add to that. I mean, your mate deserves honesty, but the way you're going to begin to rebuild trust is just absolute consistency in the truth, and it's very difficult. To me, as you'll hear us say many times, infidelity is actually the keeping of secrets. And when you keep a secret, ultimately for your mate, that will be the most discouraging thing that will happen. Because at least if you're telling them things they don't want to hear, they know you're trying to be honest and you're trying to work with them. But when you don't tell them something, and even if it is for the sake of trying to protect them, it's only going to, in the long run, hurt them and hurt the marriage.
So if they ask a question that you think is going to be too painful for them, remind them of the 24-hour rule, where we encourage people to really prayerfully consider whether or not they need the answer to the question.
Yeah, because not all the lying that the betrayer is doing has a malicious intent. Very often they really feel they are protecting their spouse from pain, but it usually doesn't play out well.
Well, the hurt spouse needs to know that they're the ones that are in charge of the information, not the unfaithful spouse.
That's exactly right.
So number 11, not supporting his or her recovery. That is, not supporting the recovery of the betrayed spouse.
Yeah, the let's just get over it and let's move on is really an incredibly unhelpful thing when it comes to helping a couple or for recovery from an affair. And that is not an uncommon mistake for the unfaithful spouse to make, thinking that somehow if they can get their mate to stop thinking about it and if they'll quit supporting him and saying, we're not going to do this, you know, you just need to get on with life, you will only be sustaining how long this thing will last.
Yeah, and I think quite naturally sometimes the spouse who's been unfaithful feels like, oh my gosh, they're never going to let go of this, they're never going to get over this. But the truth is, if you let them have their pain, if you're willing to listen to it and not rush them, they'll get over it a lot more quickly than if you don't let them talk about it.
Yeah, a little investment on the front end can pay great dividends on the back end, and avoiding it's just going to prolong the thing.
Right. In fact, we find that if a spouse makes the mistake of kind of forcing the hurt, or the unfaithful spouse makes a mistake of causing the hurt spouse to have to stuff it, not letting them deal with it, then ultimately it will come out again in about 5 to 6 years. I think we've seen that many, many times. And at that point, the marriage will truly be in trouble. In fact, most couples wait approximately 6 years before they ever seek help. And the reason they're waiting 6 years is because usually, I think, one of the two of them has decided not to deal with it, and it always hits critical mass at about 5 to 6 years.
Well, and I think even if both of them decide to not deal with it, it's still going to pop back up down the road. Because the person who's been hurt at some point is going to get very, very angry at the course that they are on with their mate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, you want to deal with it when you have a little bit of say in the manner of the way it's going to be presented. Otherwise, I mean, later it may come up in a way that really you didn't predict or something. It's sort of like, you know, recovering from any kind of illness, sometimes the recovery can be very, very painful. But if you invest in the pain of the treatment, then you don't have to deal with it in the future.
But I guess before we go on, for those of you who may be listening, who may be 5 or 6 years down the road, also don't want you to get the idea that it's too late to get help. We have had couples come into our practice, come to EMS, that may be, you know, 5 to 15 years away from the infidelity. They never got over it. It's not too late to go back and deal with it, and it's very much worthwhile.
Yes, you just want to get some peace with that over time.
Right. I thank you, because we've seen people, again, 16 to 20 years, 25 years down the road who have never dealt with it, and so there's still benefit. So don't give up just because it's been a while.
Right, because you don't want to live with a marriage that's limping along for the rest of your life. I really think God wants better for both of you.
Hear, hear. Number 12, not being consistent in the recovery plan you lay out for your spouse.
Say that again?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me.
I know exactly what that was. I wrote that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you better explain it, Rick. That didn't make sense to me.
So for those of you who forgot what I just said, it's not being consistent in the recovery plan you lay out for your spouse.
Yeah, so a lot of times what will happen as an unfaithful spouse is we'll come up with this great plan of how we're going to sit there and work things out and how we're going to be safe and we're going to give them a call before we go do such and such and we're going to going to sit there and we're not going to go out to have lunch with women anymore and we're not going to do such and such. Well, at that moment when we stop following that plan and or we alter from that plan, even if it's I'm not going to go to the bar after work with someone, that break from the kind of the agreement that you've made with your mate of how things are going to be is going to be very, very painful. So before you begin to alter your recovery plan, always, always, always talk to the hurt spouse first and try to come to a place where y'all are on the same page. At least let them know, because that unilaterally making that decision without discussing it first with them is only going to cause more pain, more fear, and for them to feel like things are spinning out of control.
Yeah, I mean, most of the clients I've worked with who made this mistake, you know, they really honestly think in their mind, the little thing they did was no big deal, but it almost invariably was a huge deal to the betrayed spouse.
Well, and if you're going to change your recovery plan, the one that you've shared with your spouse, sometimes it's very, very helpful to have a third objective party involved in that process, somebody who can kind of see things from a different vantage point. It's very easy to get entrenched on one side or the other.
So number 13 is very similar. Not keeping agreements you make. Kind of goes along with what we were just saying.
And this could actually be any kind of agreement. Going back to telling the absolute truth, if you tell your wife that you're going to take out the trash every, you know, twice a week, that's a kind of agreement that she's counting on. And if you don't keep your word, it's about as destructive as telling anything that could be perceived as a lie. Because then they begin to feel like they can't count on you and that your word doesn't mean anything.
And maybe in some ways that comes back a little bit to not lying. But I think to avoid conflict, it's not uncommon for the unfaithful spouse to just say whatever they think their mate wants to hear. To keep them happy. And so it almost ends up being a conflict resolution piece that we just agree to do something quickly so that we can make them happy, when in reality, we really don't want to do that thing. And at that point, that ends up being what we call passive aggressive. And passive aggressive, what passive aggressive means is that you will very easily agree. You've kind of got this dilemma. You want to do what you want to do. At the same time, you want to do what the other person wants to do. So then you agree to do what the first person wants you to do. But then you get mad because you don't get to do what you want to do. So you end up doing what you want to do and not do what you agreed to do. And then you blame them for the fact that you didn't do what they wanted because it's really their fault somehow. And that's a great passive-aggressive move at some
point. I didn't get that, Rick. Could you repeat
that one?
No.
Well, really, and a lot of times in their mind, it's connected very much to what led up to the affair. That you were acting like one thing, you were agreeing with what they were saying, and then you were doing whatever you wanted. So that's a huge trigger for the hurting spouse.
Yeah, it sounds kind of cliche, but it sounds like this is one of those times where actions really do speak a lot louder than words. Your spouse is really going to be watching what you're doing to see if there's consistency with what you're saying.
Well, and I think that's a really important point, because the hurting spouse has trouble believing anything the unfaithful spouse has said. And so you, the unfaithful spouse, really need to stick to your actions because your words don't mean that much.
Right. And like I said, when you're dealing with an angry person, it's very, very difficult to be maybe straight up and honest and forward, because you don't want to die, or it feels like you're going to die. And that's where I think you agree to things that you really don't intend to do, and you've got to be able to say what you mean and mean what you say.
Most definitely. And I know we can get Rick probably talking for 2 hours on this next one, but telling your spouse to forgive you.
I can't talk for 2 hours on this one. Does somebody else want to start first before I jump in on this one?
No, you can go ahead.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting. The problem I've got when we sit there, whether it's hurt or unfaithful, I mean, it's great that we take responsibility and say we did something wrong. At the same time, when we tell someone else they've got to forgive us, ultimately, when I say, you know, will you forgive me? It's almost like you're putting this moral imperative on the other person to have to go ahead and forgive you. And it puts them almost in a very, very awkward place. In fact, I think that many well-meaning therapists and ministries and churches actually teach something that's very difficult for someone when you're dealing with an affair situation. So rather than asking the question, will you forgive me, what I like to teach, and everybody on our staff, we kind of teach this. We just say, I hope you will be able to forgive me for what I've done, because most certainly I do not deserve to be forgiven for this. But I hope God can give you the grace to do that, so that in the long run, we're not putting that moral imperative on them, and we're not putting them in an awkward position where they're doing it for us. When someone forgives, first and foremost, that needs to be that vertical forgiveness we've talked about on earlier programs between them and God. And as the one who's done the wounding, all I want to be able to do is provide the necessary support to them, just whatever I can do to help them get to that point. That's what's important.
And the thing that I would add is please, please, please do not take your Bible out and find a scripture verse and tell your spouse that they must forgive you because God told them to. You're absolutely right. They will have to forgive you, but that is between them and God. And it's a process that you can't demand of them. And if you take the Bible out and throw scripture at them, it's just not going to be good for anybody.
Yeah, usually the reason we seek forgiveness from another person is because the person asking for forgiveness really has a problem understanding that they've already received their forgiveness from God. But if we're at a place where we think that we have to have forgiveness from our mate in order to be okay, then ultimately what's happening is our mate is our God. And I don't need my mate to forgive me. Forgiveness, as we say, is always a gift you give yourself. What I need, basically, is to try to help my mate release their wound, help them heal so that they're not damaged and they're not wounded by what I've done to them. But I'm not going to be able to be in that position until first I'm able to accept the grace and the mercy and the love that God is extending to me. Apart from that, I'm going to be in a great deal of trouble.
Yeah, because a lot of times I'll ask clients, do you forgive really quickly or does it take you a while? And I think that's a good thing to ask yourself as you're going through this, because a lot of times people who forgive too quickly are actually scared of losing the relationship. And people who forgive really, really slowly think unforgiveness is going to keep the other person from doing it.
And people who are begging their mate to forgive them are simply concerned about what their actions are going to cost them.
And the loss of the relationship.
Right, and not what their actions are going to cost their mate.
You get these two talking about forgiveness, we could be here till 1 o'clock.
True.
I think we're up against a break again, but we will come back and try to take it on home with the 20 most common mistakes the unfaithful spouse makes.
Okay, welcome back to A Fair Recovery Radio, Radio to the Power of God. I'm here with my co-hosts, John and Leslie, and we're talking about the 20 most common mistakes that the unfaithful spouse makes. We're still hoping somebody out there is going to call in tonight. Last week, the West Coast carried us. Maybe the East Coast will start calling in this week. Who knows?
But we do love the questions and comments.
Yeah. They're afraid to call in tonight.
We get tired of hearing our own voices, even though...
Actually, we get tired of hearing Rick's voice.
Exactly. But we can sit there and talk all night long, so I don't know that the station would allow us to do that, but they would be amazed at how long we could go on some of these topics, because there's just a lot to be said, because, again, our heart is for you guys to be able to heal and to be able to gain perspective on this thing, and ultimately to be able to see God through all of these things. And to do that, I think you need to begin to think about, you know, what are the pitfalls that you can make as you go through this. So, on with the list.
On with the list. Number 15, not answering all of their questions.
Yeah, not a good idea. And I think we probably have as much trouble convincing people to do this one as anything. And we've got some caveats on this that I think are important. But as we've talked about on previous programs, for the hurt spouse to begin to close the chapter on some sort of betrayal, whether you're dealing with pornography, whether you're dealing with an emotional relationship, or whether you're dealing with a full-blown sexual affair, if you don't answer their questions continue to roll around up in their mind, and it's very difficult for them to ultimately feel like they've got the history written, they understand what's happened, so that they can drive a stake in the ground and begin to move forward. And withholding information is only going to create a great deal of difficulty for them.
Right, and as far as what they're asking, that's one issue. But the other issue is how often they're asking and how many, because your hurt spouse is going to ask the same question over and over and over and over. And part of it is that they want to know that they're going to get the same answer over and over and over again. They need to stick their finger in the wound to be able to begin to heal.
Right. Another thing that I think is really important is for the unfaithful spouse, when your mate is asking questions, if you feel they're asking questions out of anger, information that they may not really want to hear, then we highly recommend that you just ask them to pray for 24 hours and make sure they still want that information, that you will gladly give them that information, but just to pray about whether or not this is really information that they need.
Well, and the other thing is that they can't really forgive you if they don't know what it is. But we have a caller.
Good. Hey. Kathy, are you there?
I am.
Good. Well, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I've got something I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
Explain sex addiction to me.
John.
And if John doesn't get it right, we'll fix it.
Okay, thank you.
Well, probably have to start out, Kathy, by saying there's probably no two mental health professionals who would give the exact same definition on that. And even the sort of the concept itself is hotly debated in a lot of the literature. But usually what would be classified as sex addiction would have several kind of key factors involved with it. One of it being a compulsive sexual behavior, an inability to stop despite repeated attempts. Sometimes the definitions of sexual addiction talk about what's called neurochemical tolerance, meaning that the person builds up a resistance to whatever their sort of drug of choice is, whether it happens to be prostitution or pornography, that they need to kind of add more and more to get the same sort of kick with it. And so very often they may start with sort of some low-level stuff and their behavior generally increases. But usually it's, just to kind of simplify it, as sort of a compulsive pattern that the person has been unable to stop despite really wanting to.
Okay, what if a person hasn't tried to stop?
Well, it's just like, to me that would be something like alcoholism, where the person, might be drinking themselves to death but may have no desire whatsoever to give it up.
Oh, okay, then my next thing is, have you ever heard of somebody having two separate types of affairs at the same time?
Yes.
Okay, like you can have sex addiction and then have a different type?
That would be me.
That would be you?
Yes.
Okay, so explain that. How does that work? Because doesn't sex addicts generally aren't looking for intimacy?
Right. And so what happens, I think, sometimes for the sex addict, they continue to act out in kind of their preferred venues. And at the same time, their boundaries, they're sick. I was sick. And it is a disease. And at one point, what actually occurred was I actually began to care about another person, when in the past all I had done was kind of used individuals. I came to a point where actually I got what I call hooked. And at that point I kind of shifted into more of a relationship addiction, which was a totally new sort of thing for me. But I would still have called it an addiction because, Patrick Carnes has a great book out called Don't Call It Love. But I thought I'd actually fallen in love, but what in reality had done is I'd actually become addicted to a person, so I'd cross-addicted to something very different. But it certainly was an affair.
Well, I'm sorry, Leslie, go ahead.
The other thing that I would just add to that, Kathy, is that intimacy within an affair is a different paradigm than intimacy within a marriage. So it feels very, very different, and they're getting a different charge out of it. When somebody's falling in love, intimacy feels very safe. They feel very close and very connected. Within marriage, it's a whole different thing.
Okay. Well, here's my dilemma, and it's the battle I've been having, okay? Big one. My husband's a sex addict, but he had a 9-year affair with a woman that was pretty ongoing every day, pretty close for the first 3 years. Then she moved away to California.
Right.
Then when she moved to California, she was flying up here 3-4 times a year for 2 or 3-4 days at a time.
Right.
But they were calling and talking to each other, 3-4 times a week.
Right.
And she knew more about my life, more about me, and my husband discussed our issues and problems with her. She got to put in her input. And basically sometimes he would even go with her advice. And I wouldn't even begin, I didn't even know we were even maybe sometimes having that issue. Okay, So now we're talking about being trustful and trying to rebuild trust, correct?
Right.
I try to talk to my husband about that affair, And how could he not have cared about her? Because he says he had no feelings there whatsoever, none. It was strictly sex, just his loins talking. But 9 years and getting sex 9 days out of that year, or, you know, 9 days a year, just doesn't add up to me. And when I'm trying to tell him your behavior doesn't match your words, then he kind of gets defensive with me a little bit. And it's frustrating for me because I'm going, okay, there's two separate types of things going on here then, because you feel nothing for her, but yet you feel compassion for her. You guys have your arguments. You hang up on each other on the phone. You're calling each other back, apologizing, not wanting to break up, and, you know, and planning around whatever you can plan around to meet together, and you're telling her things that I have no clue at all about you and your life. And then you're telling me that it was because you didn't care what she thought and you thought I was pure and you didn't want me to think less of you. That, to me, is an emotional affair. He cared enough to send her a computer. He cares enough to call her. When he I mean, at one point during this, I was diagnosed with cancer. Okay?
Oh, boy. Oh, I'm sorry.
My husband was nowhere to be found. Couldn't take me to a doctor's appointment. Couldn't go with chemo with me. I would cry. He'd tell me I was overdramatic. He'd tell her, oh, my wife's got cancer. She just needs to get a life. But yet, he didn't have any feelings for her, he keeps telling me. And I keep feeling like he's lying to me because he has made the comment that, well, you know, I think an emotional affair would be worse, Kathy, you know, and I think you're hurt bad enough. And, you know, and what do you want me to say, that I was in love with this woman? Well, I wasn't. Well, so it leaves me confused, and it leaves me on the other side of how the heck do I ever learn to trust you when I feel your behavior and your words are just not matching. Explain this to me.
I had a case, and actually I've had several cases. I'm thinking of one where one of my gentlemen actually had a 4-year affair and about an 8-year affair. He is an addict's addict. And this relationship had all the appearance of being an emotional affair. I am completely convinced that it was not an emotional affair for this guy. It was purely sexual. Now, I don't know what it meant to the woman, but for him, he basically, part of his thing, and for sex addicts, this is very true, that they think they're masters of the universe. That's part of that grandiose thinking, and his part of his trip was trying to get her to do whatever it is he wanted her to do, and it was really a very sick part of him that just used her. And I mean, not knowing your husband, I can't say anything about that, but I can tell you I have seen several cases that I know they didn't care for the person, but they were ongoing relationships where they talked on a regular basis, but it was like more or less like using a prostitute. I don't know if you guys want to say anything about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, sometimes the sort of the narcissistic tendencies of the addict is they get very good at manipulating the person and sort of emotionally using them, and they may tell them things they want to hear and absolutely mean none of it, but they can be very good at that manipulation. And so the person may very well believe that and feel that there's this really strong connection when really it's just this superficial exploitation that's going on.
Yeah, because she believed that he had feelings for her, and she actually believed they were going to be together for the rest of their life. She told me that because I did talk to her. But my husband, on the other hand, I'll say, well, why were you going to send her a computer then? Why were you going to send her our grandchildren's computer? And he'd say, because I felt sorry for her. That's emotion.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean that he's in love with her and wants to leave you. It means that, you know, he's trying to maintain the relationship so he can continue using this poor woman.
Well,
even though it's only for 6 to 9 days out of 365 days?
It's the game.
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding.
No. No, and even doing the computer, which may seem like a kindness, that could have even been out of guilt.
No, and I think it's just one of those times that I think it'd be important for you, Kathy, to try to not see it purely from your perspective too, because you're thinking of it from the standpoint of a rational individual who, you know, and from sometimes the feminine way of thinking and the masculine way of thinking can be very different on this. You know, for you to do the behavior that he's doing, there would have to be an emotional connection, because otherwise,
absolutely,
you know, you would never do it.
Right.
But don't project that onto him, you know, and assume that there must be some kind of emotional tie going on for him to be able to do these things. He might, you know, be able to do it very well without any kind of real emotional connection going on there.
Well, if that's true, how the heck will I ever know if he truly has those kind of feelings for me? Because, I get the I love yous, but I got the I love yous then too, you know, and if he can manipulate her that well and make her, you know, believe they were best friends and she knew him so well and he felt all these or did all these things for her, and he does that stuff for me, how in the heck am I ever supposed to believe his actions or his words?
Well, and Kathy, as we're kind of wrapping this up tonight, I do appreciate you calling, but the thing that I really want to say is that most sex addicts don't use their wives the same way that they use people outside the marriage. Most sex addicts, and I do not know your husband, but most sex addicts really do love their wives. They really care about them. And what's hard for the person in your position is it's so easy to think, well, if he really loved me, he never would have done this, especially with another person for 9 years. But in their head, it works completely differently. And the fact that he didn't want you to think less of him really speaks of the addiction, not of his care for her or his lack of care for you.
Right. I know that's a very, very confusing situation for you, Kathy. And you know, the fact that he is still with you says something. You know, and the one thing we know about sexual addiction typically is the person doesn't want to lose their mate. The sexual addiction is something beyond, not okay, but certainly something beyond.
Okay.
So you hang in there and keep praying.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Kathy.
And, guys, we need to start wrapping up for the program tonight. John and Leslie, y'all have anything you want to close with tonight?
No, just thank you so much for listening, and thank you for calling, Kathy.
And, John, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, man. I just, you know, with Kathy's situation and others out there, you know, I know we say it very, very often, and it may sound kind of trite sometimes, but there really is hope in these situations. And sometimes when we're just flooding with the anger and the sense of betrayal and so forth, it's really easy to lose sight of that. But our God's a big God, and there's always hope.
May God bless you this week, and I hope you guys are able to just continue to see God in all things.
Amen and good night.